From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Hello and welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Kim Lewis, and joining me on the panel this week are VOA Congressional Correspondent Catherine Gibson and VOA White House Correspondent Anita Powell. Welcome, Catherine and Anita.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Always a pleasure.
Well, here are the issues. President Joe Biden called on Congress to enact a three-month suspension of the federal tax on gasoline and diesel fuel as a stopgap measure meant to curb the rising energy prices that have driven inflation to levels unseen since the late 1970s. The White House said in a statement that it will support the suspension until the end of September. The Senate cast a key vote to advance newly released bipartisan gun safety legislation, a major step moving the bill forward as lawmakers face pressure to respond to the string of recent mass shootings in the U.S. State election officials and lawmakers testified to the House of Representatives Select Committee probing the January 6, 2021 attack on the Capitol building that former President Trump and his allies waged a relentless pressure campaign, pushing them to break the law in a bid to keep him in power. In Afghanistan, the death toll continues to rise following a powerful earthquake. Taliban authorities, citing initial reports, said the quake, which hit during early hours on Wednesday, killed more than 1,000 people and injured hundreds of others in the country's southeast. Well, those are the issues, and let's get started. Anita, President Biden called on Congress to enact a three-month suspension of the federal tax on gasoline and diesel fuel. What is he hoping to accomplish with this, and what will be his next step to help Americans deal with inflation?
So the goal, obviously, is to, as the president likes to say, give a little breathing room to American families who are struggling with like record high gas prices, which are about $6 a gallon in some parts of the United States. But as you just mentioned, it's not as simple as that. This sounds like a good idea, but it's not a fait accompli. First of all, Congress has to sign on to this federal gas tax holiday, which, as you said, will go through September. And the president has also asked states to get on board and give their own gas tax holidays to bring down the price further. But then there's another ingredient, which is the gas companies, which need to help pass on the savings to the consumer. And there's no guarantee that they will. I mean, this is a free market. They don't have to do that. The Secretary of Energy is meeting with about seven CEOs of major oil and gas companies to, I guess, persuade them to do that and also to increase their refining capacity and to pump more into the system. He's also releasing some more from the Strategic Petroleum Reserves, everything to kind of try to, first of all, just work the supply and demand economic side of things to increase demand to make the price go down, but also to massage the situation and get the human beings involved in it to also help manipulate this situation and bring the prices down for the American consumer. And the reason this is happening over summer, as White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre said, is this is traditional traveling season for families. They're driving more, they're going on holiday. And so this is a time when a lot of these families are going to be feeling this pinch and appreciate the savings.
And, you know, as Anita mentioned, all of this will have to be passed over in the U.S. Congress, and monitoring lawmaker reaction over this past week to Biden's proposal, there's not just opposition on the Republican side, where Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell has said that this is really an outrageous effort by the Biden administration to avoid what they should be responsible for, these high gas prices. There's also been a tepid reaction over on the Democrat side. And according to some reports, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi was not terribly in favor of taking this approach. She did release a statement on Wednesday saying that the Biden administration had taken some key steps towards relieving this problem, namely Strategic Petroleum Reserve, letting that loose. She held that. She said that Democrats had legislation pending that would also relieve some of the gas price hikes. But she wasn't fully in favor of this gas tax suspension, if you read between the lines of that statement. So I think Biden is going to have a hard road over on Capitol Hill in terms of getting everybody together on this issue.
And I just want to jump in and underscore that even the Biden administration is not saying that this is the solution to all that ails the American petroleum consumer. As Secretary of Energy Jennifer Granholm said, the real solution lies in energy independence and less dependence on fossil fuels. As Republican Senator John Thune said, this is a Band-Aid. This is something to allow us to limp along to the next station. But that doesn't portend well for it passing through the Congress.
And it doesn't portend well for Democrats who are running for re-election this fall. It's all well and good to say that we need to have greater energy independence, but that's something that's going to be happening down the road. That doesn't ease the pain for the ordinary American who's going in some places and spending $6 a gallon on gas. And when they see that and spend that, they're going to be remembering that Democrats are in charge of Congress and that they're ultimately, whether it's right or not, held responsible for the economic condition of this country. Democrats are already facing a hard road ahead in terms of winning control of the House and keeping control of the Senate. This is going to make their path even harder.
And I just want to underscore for our listeners who are not in the United States, which is all of our listeners, U.S. gas prices of $6 a gallon, I think we realize those are still among the more, I hate to say it, but like reasonable prices. In Hong Kong, it's $11 a gallon. In Norway, it's nearly $11. Denmark, $10. Finland, $10. So I think it just needs to be acknowledged that this is definitely a burden on American consumers, but the United States probably is not feeling the pinch as much as other countries.
Also, President Biden is saying that inflation and the rise of gas prices has to do with Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Is this helping Biden or hurting him?
That's an interesting question. I mean, he loves this term, the Putin price hike, which he trotted out a few months ago. It depends who you ask if this is hurting or helping him, because he made the point that cutting off 1 million barrels a day of Russian oil is, of course, going to impact the consumer. But as he argues, it's the right thing to do because Vladimir Putin's invasion of Ukraine is a repudiation of established rules-based world order. And that is something that he argues that the United States and allies cannot allow in the modern world. And that is a moral argument that I think a lot of Americans probably hear and might agree with. Blaming of this on Putin, it is true. It is valid, but it depends whether it's going to resonate with Americans who, as Catherine mentioned, are heading to the polls in a few months.
That's really the big thing now. People are looking at how will this affect those who are wanting to be reelected and what their constituents are thinking of them when they do go and place their votes.
Right, because economic approval ratings are really important, and Biden's economic approval ratings are in the lowest they've been. His overall approval ratings are the lowest they've been for quite some time, and this does matter in terms of how people vote, because they vote with their pocketbooks. They vote with their bottom line in mind. So this is definitely an issue, maybe not as much as, or maybe equal, I guess, to the other issues we'll be talking about today, including gun legislation, which is on the table right now.
Speaking of which, the Senate broke through nearly 30 years of stalemate on gun control legislation by voting 64-34 to advance an 80-page gun safety bill to respond to the mass shootings in Buffalo, New York, and Uvalde, Texas, that left 31 people dead, including 19 school children. So, Catherine, how significant is this step?
Well, it's the most significant effort at gun control legislation in the U.S. Congress in a generation. We have not seen anything of this size pass the U.S. Congress since the 1990s in the Brady Bill. And of course, that was a very different time in the U.S. Congress when there was a lot more bipartisan cooperation. So the fact that Democrats and Republicans were able to come together on this package, as small as it may seem to some gun control groups and activists, really does mean something and really speaks to the mood in this country after the Buffalo and Texas shootings, when there was a real sense on the Republican side that they needed to do something this time around and not just rely on saying that this was an infringement on Second Amendment rights. The deal that's been worked out, as Republicans will tell you on Capitol Hill, doesn't infringe on that key Second Amendment right, the right to bear arms, that is one of the cornerstones of the Republican Party that they feel is important to defend in terms of their voters, in terms of American citizens. All of this new legislation would not harm law-abiding citizens. And that is how they were able to get this deal through, work out a deal with Democrats, who really have also on their side been working with the activist groups. I know Chuck Schumer has said many times that when this first came up to be an option, he talked to some of those gun rights groups that have marched throughout the years after every mass shooting in this country and told them, look, we are not going to get everything through. This just is not going to happen in the current political environment. We are not going to get an assault weapon ban through. What we can do are these incremental steps. And the idea among Democrats and talking to them on Capitol Hill is that if you start doing these modest packages, then you will eventually build up and build the public support for larger gun control legislation. I have been up on Capitol Hill for 7 years now. I've sadly lost count of how many mass shootings I have seen in terms of the reaction on Capitol Hill and seen nothing happen. This is a really unusual occurrence that lawmakers have actually taken action and are going to pass this.
Except not to throw cold water on it. This is a compromise, right, Catherine? Like, nobody's getting exactly what they want, as you have underscored. This is not as far reaching as some gun control advocates would like, and it's too limiting for those who believe in their right to unrestricted arms bearing.
There's a lot of debate already about how states are going to implement that legislation and whether it will be fully implemented in some places. And this is why Chuck Schumer did have to reach out to those activist groups ahead of time and warn them, look, we need your support for this, but this is not going to be everything that you wanted it to be.
And also, the legislation includes $11 billion for mental health services and $2 billion for community-based anti-violence programs. How is Congress looking at this provision? Is it very important to have this in there?
Well, this is certainly part of the argument that congressional Republicans make in terms of the response that the country should be having to mass shootings. They argue that checks on gun buying, on background checks, harm law-abiding American citizens, and that instead we should address the underlying mental health issues that cause mass shooters to enact this violence. And so some of that mental health funding will address that problem in their view. That's why it's important to get that in there. They also argue, of course, enhanced school safety would also prevent some of these shootings. That's a big debate in this country because we're learning more about what happened in Uvalde, Texas, how local police responded to that shooting, and whether or not anything would have actually stopped the shooting in terms of school safety.
One other aspect of this is the National Rifle Association, who is immediately opposed to this legislation. How does Congress see the NRA now? Is it as powerful as it used to be?
Well, I think you saw there was the NRA convention just a few days after that shooting in Uvalde, Texas, and you still saw many prominent Republican politicians like Senator Ted Cruz, like former President Donald Trump, speaking at that convention and really pledging to protect the Second Amendment rights of Americans. I think what's also important is to pull out a little bit here and look at American public opinion on this, because while it is a very important issue for Republicans, when you look at Americans broadly, there is broad support for a lot of this gun control legislation, for background checks, for not allowing people under the age of 21 to own assault weapons. That was certainly a player in the Uvalde, Texas shooting. If you look at the public opinion on this, there is broad support for a lot of gun control. Americans, of course, always say that it's important to maintain those Second Amendment rights, but it is growing as an issue that Americans understand that we need to have some of these checks in place.
Well, it's time now for a quick break, and when we return, televised hearings continue on the House Select Committee probing the January 6, 2021 attack on the Capitol building. Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype, VOA Congressional Correspondent Catherine Gibson and VOA White House Correspondent Anita Powell. In the fourth public hearing of the House January 6th Select Committee, it focused on the persistent pressure applied by then-President Trump and his personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, on state officials and election workers to overturn the 2020 election results. What are some takeaways from this?
I've been watching this in between my duties at the White House. I'm kind of glued to this hearing. And I had a slip of the tongue with my kid. I said, you know, I need some time because mommy's watching the trial. And I was like, oh, no, it's not a trial. There's no judicial power. They're not going to hand down indictments from this. Nobody's going to necessarily go to jail out of this hearing. But what this feels like is that America's on trial here. This is all of our dirty laundry laid out for the world to see, which is a remarkable feature of the American system, that we confront that, that we do examine our weaknesses, our frailties, our mistakes. But it does really feel like the United States, the system, the guardrails, the rules that we set up for ourselves when we set up this system are on trial.
That's a great way of putting it, Anita, and that, as you mentioned, there won't be any indictments that come out of these hearings specifically. What's being tried is the court of public opinion, of maintaining the American public's attention on, as you mentioned it, these key issues that really could undermine our democracy. We already had an impeachment of former President Donald Trump related to the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. So in a sense, we've already covered a lot of this ground. But when I sit inside that hearing room and hear the testimony from the witnesses, it's really striking to me how much new information we're learning about the depth and breadth of former President Trump's efforts to undermine the 2020 election, and really how close we came at so many different points to the American system not functioning, to being broken, to the democratic process being overturned. And at each level, we had people who upheld their oath of office, who believed in the American system, who really defended the idea of the United States. And what we're really hearing over and over again from lawmakers, both Democratic and Republican, because remember, there are two Republicans on this committee who voted to impeach Donald Trump. They are saying that this is a key point for the United States. We have to understand how close we came on January 6, 2021 to the American system being overturned, and to make sure that we don't make those same mistakes again.
Also, the American public is seeing just how it has affected people's personal and professional lives. Three state officials, two from Georgia and one from Arizona, and a mother and daughter who were election workers in Fulton County, Georgia, testified before the Select Committee about Trump's efforts to change the election results and the effect it had on their personal and professional lives. So this was very compelling testimony.
I felt very bad for Shea Moss and her mother when they described the harassment, the fear. No American, as she, I think, said, should have to live like this. And the president of the United States is supposed to represent all Americans, not target individual Americans.
That's right. It was a really striking moment in the hearing room to hear Ruby Freeman, who is another election worker and the mother of Shea Moss, the Georgia election worker, say, "The president of the United States personally targeted me." And no president of the United States should ever do that to an American citizen. He's there to represent Americans, not to attack them. And we heard Donald Trump's own words played in that hearing room, directly targeting Ruby Freeman and alleging that she was passing hard drives that contained files that would falsify election results. And we had this incredible moment where she was asked, well, what were you passing back and forth with your daughter? And she said, it was a mint. It was a candy. It brought home the personal nature of this enormous effort to overturn the 2020 election results, and how it all came down even to the personal level of people who are simply just trying to help American voters exercise their democratic right, which is to vote.
Absolutely. And I guess we will just have to see as these hearings continue just what other compelling information we will get from it. And on an international note, a strong earthquake struck eastern Afghanistan early Wednesday, killing more than 1,000 people, according to officials from the country's ruling Taliban regime. The international community has really largely left the country since the Islamist group seized control in August 2021. So what is the latest relief that is going on in Afghanistan right now?
President Biden has mobilized USAID, this is the U.S. government's development arm, to see how they can help. And what's notable, by the way, is the notoriously media-shy leader of the Taliban, Haibatullah Akhundzada, has made an appeal to the world to assist as much as they can. Because this is really, I think if you zoom out, this is a real test for the Taliban government. And it's really unfair and it's tragic that it comes at the cost of 1,000 or more, almost certainly more, lives in this rural part of Afghanistan that's on the border with Pakistan. Relief agencies are rushing in, trying to see how they can intervene, evacuating people by helicopters from this extremely underdeveloped region. But this is going to reverberate for some time. There are going to be, and I hate to use this metaphor, but there are going to be aftershocks for this, for governance, for life in Afghanistan. And this is going to be a very resonant event. And we saw this, by the way, before in Haiti. We've seen this in Pakistan before, where earthquakes have really not just destabilized the literal ground under people's feet, but just all of the things that hold up quote unquote civilized society. I think that's what a lot of us are watching right now in Afghanistan and concerned about, because if there's one country that deserves maybe a little bit of peace and a little bit of grace, it's probably Afghanistan, which has had a very rough ride over the last entire history of Afghanistan, but especially over the last 20 years.
Before we close out the show, I just wanted to get your views on what issue weighs on you this week. Let's start with you, Anita.
Well, I'm watching two things, both on my beloved African continent. Number one, aid agencies Save the Children is sounding the alarm over a possible famine in Somalia. This has many causes, but one of the direct causes is, of course, the inability of Ukraine to export grain to buyers around the world. But this could be worse than the famine that hit Somalia in 2010, which I believe 250,000 people died. This is already an impoverished East African country that doesn't need this extra stress. And so I am watching that. I'm also watching a possible flare-up between Rwanda and Congo. These are two neighboring countries in the Great Lakes region of Africa. This is going to be talked about during the Commonwealth Summit in Kigali and also during the BRICS summit, which is virtual. I just want to remind everybody that the Congolese civil war was the deadliest conflict since World War II. At least 5 million people died. So I think we should all be concerned about any sort of resumption in hostilities in this beautiful, resource-rich, but extremely troubled part of the world.
And Catherine, what weighs on you this week?
Well, you know, I often tell friends and family here in the United States in my own life, I try to convey to them how small and personal it can be to cover the U.S. Congress. We see these people in the United States every day on TV. We know that they're wrestling with some of the biggest issues we can discuss: American democracy, gun control, abortion. But when it really comes down to it, they're just average people who are walking the hallways, who are very fragile, just like us. And because there are only 100 people serving in the U.S. Senate, the loss of even one can be very important in terms of numbers of passing legislation. This past weekend, we actually heard some very unfortunate news that a Republican Senator, Kevin Cramer, from the Midwestern state of North Dakota, had been involved in a very serious accident working in his yard back home and apparently so severely injured his own hand that he has to stay at home in North Dakota because of a risk of severe infection. And indeed, if it worsens, he may have to have part of that hand amputated. So it's funny when you have these people who you see every day. I followed the senator in his home state of North Dakota, and you really understand that this is a world that is at a personal level. And each person in the U.S. Senate is indeed a real person, a fragile person who can be hurt and will impact the way the U.S. Senate functions on a daily basis. So, of course, sending out all of the best wishes to the senator and his family, that he has a speedy, quick recovery. Remember, these are real people making the laws. I think that's always important to remember.
Well said. And thank you both for bringing out these other issues out there that are still weighing on your minds. And we're going to end the show on those notes. My thanks go to our panelists, VOA Congressional Correspondent Catherine Gibson and VOA White House Correspondent Anita Powell. I'm Kim Lewis, and be sure to visit us on our new website at voaafrica.com. And thanks for joining us for Issues in the News.